Now to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. And I believe we're down to verse 12 of this chapter. Revelation 17 and verse 12. Now let me back up just a little bit here. Start in verse 8, just to kind of get the flow here. "The beast that thou sawest was and is not shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. They that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth." And we've already just shown, like from verse 18, that the woman here is a city. And it's a city seated on seven mountains, which is Rome, the Vatican City. Verse 10, "And there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. The beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and he is of the seven, and goeth into perdition." Looking at that, and there's a... I don't know if I want to say I definitely believe that, but I think there's a strong possibility that could be Judas Iscariot being reincarnate. We looked at some of the verses on that last week and talked about that some. Verse 12, "And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings." And we'd started on this last week, but so you got seven kings, which are the seven heads. Then you also have ten more kings, which are these ten horns. And it says they have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. So they don't have a kingdom, but they're kings. And it says they receive power as kings for 1 hour with the beast. I'm not sure if that's a literal hour or just a short span of time. I don't know what to do with that for certain. But I think it's clear of what they are at that point. Verse 13, let's read down to verse 14, I guess, here. "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast." So the woman was seated on the beast, but then these kings, these ten kings, these ten horns are on the beast as well. So the beast is where all of this originates from. The woman, the seven kings, and these ten kings. And they come from him. And this power that they have for a short time as kings, but not having a kingdom, they give to the beast. Verse 14, "These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful." So there's a ten-king federation that's seen here. Now, for a long time, it's been believed that the British Common Market, which I'm not even sure, I guess that's what the European Union grew out of, what was the British Common Market. A long time it was thought that that was the key to this, and that was what the ten horns are. The problem is that there's many more than ten nations involved in the European Union at this time. So it could shrink back to be the ten, and that could still be it, but I don't know. But at some point and somewhere, this confederation of ten kings or ten... maybe even nations, comes together at the end time, and they make war with the Lamb, but he wins. We win in the end. But we're looking at some verses in Daniel last week, so let's jump back there again. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2 once again. We'll start with that, look at that once again. And this primarily relates to these ten kings related to the ten horns on the beast. Daniel chapter 2, and verse 37. This is the first vision that Daniel gets. Thou, O King, art a King of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of heaven, hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. This is Babylon. This is Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, the kingdom there. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. To me, this is one, and this is a side note, but sometimes people say, well, proof from the Bible, a prophecy that's been fulfilled. Well, right there. Daniel was writing when Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon, and Babylon was the world power. He's just identified the next two kingdoms that are going to come into power after Babylon is defeated. The Medo-Persian Empire was the next one. And then it was under the Medo-Persians, of course, that Israel went back into the land, rebuilt the temple, and rebuilt the walls. But then they were conquered by the Greek Empire. That's fulfilled prophecy. Because Daniel spoke of that without having humanly possible any knowledge of that coming to pass. So there's a fulfilled prophecy. And so he speaks of the next two kingdoms coming. Then verse 40, the fourth kingdom, that's the Roman Empire, shall be strong as iron. So there's you go from gold to brass to silver to iron. There's a degradation, I guess you might say, and that's not the right term, but degeneration is the other one I can think of, and that's really not right either. But you see the value is decreasing, okay? He says, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these things, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, you've gotten down to the legs, now the feet and toes. You got 2 feet, but then the toes, there's 10 toes, right? That comes out of that fourth kingdom. Whereas thou sawest feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it the strength of iron, forasmuch as thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet are part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. So the strength of these kingdoms is diminished as they regress or descend, I guess you would say, as well. Babylon was much stronger than the Medo-Persian Empire. Medo-Persian was stronger than Greece, and Greece was stronger than Rome. And it was basically Rome was never defeated. No. The Medo-Persians defeated, conquered the Babylonians, and took over. The Greeks conquered the Medo-Persians and took over. The Romans conquered the Greeks and became the world power. The Roman Empire was never defeated. And that could be part of what it's talking about, the mixing of the iron and clay, the weakness there. It just basically fell apart. It got so big and so expansive that it just kind of disintegrated, I guess you could say. Verse 42, as the toes of the feet are part of iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings, now we've made a huge jump here. Again, as Daniel is getting the vision, he doesn't necessarily see the time span and maybe even some gaps in between. It's someone's described it as like mountain peaks of prophecy. You stand and you look across and you see the mountain peaks, but you don't see the valleys below. There's things that are hidden from your view. And that's what Daniel's seeing, these kingdoms. But what he doesn't see is the gap from the feet of iron and clay to the toes, or the iron to the toes of iron and clay. The huge gap, the 2,000-year gap in between there. And so we've jumped now. For us, looking back at it, we see the span there to verse 44, and we've jumped to the future, even for us today. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume in all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain, without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So the verses 44 and 45 are looking to where we're at in Revelation 17 of Jesus Christ coming and defeating and destroying this 10-king federation that raises up. Now, there's some more in this next passage I'm going to look at in chapter 7, but are there any, before we jump there, any questions or comments? Okay, Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7 and verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. Now the vision is of beasts, but it parallels Daniel 2 as far as the kingdoms. The fourth beast, again, is the Roman Empire. It says, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, and in his horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. Drop down to verse 19. Daniel 7, verse 19. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast. So, he gives the initial vision in verses 7 and 8. Now he's going to expound upon that. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the 10 horns that are in his head, and the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Then he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall rise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and shall subdue 3 kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given unto his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. So we jumped right into the tribulation once again. A time is a year, times is 2 years, and the dividing of times is a half a year, 3.5 years. That's when this king, this power, comes into play at that midpoint. But judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion and consume and destroy it unto the end. So, putting this all together, and I'm maybe not going to have a whole lot of support for where I'm going with, but this is kind of the way I see the thing. You've got the Roman Empire that you kind of dissipated, but then it gets revived during the tribulation. I believe this is part of what brings Catholicism into this. They're a part of that revived Roman Empire. Constantine was an emperor of Rome. Constantine is basically responsible for the formation of the Roman Catholic Church. He set himself up. He was king, Roman Empire, set himself up as the head of the church as well. And he brought in Christianity and Babylonian paganism and even some of the Old Testament and mashed it all together to bring unity into his kingdom. And that's what you have in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, it developed much from that point, but that was the initiating of that thing, the start of that thing. And as Rome continues to gather power and so forth, this is the revived Roman Empire that we're seeing over there. There was a, I think it was yesterday I saw it. Yeah, it was yesterday. There was on Drudge, there was an article about UN is going to raise the flag of the Holy See at the end of the week. The Holy See. C, S-E-E. It's a Latin word, and it means seat. The Holy Seat. The flag that represents Catholicism. Do you know that the Roman Catholic Church, and I've talked about the ambassadors, over 100 nations have full-time ambassadors to the Vatican. You know, the U.S. has an ambassador, just like we got ambassador to Greece and Spain, and we have an ambassador to the Vatican. Did you know that, and I wasn't aware of this, the Vatican has an ambassador to the U.N.? They are the Vatican is a recognized by the UN as a political entity, and that's what that flag is. To be raised for the first time this coming week.
Do they say why? Why do they want to bring recognition to that? Or what's the point of raising that flag?
To show that they are a member of the UN. Now, they are a non-voting member. That and the Palestinians are recognized as members, but they are non-voting members. But they are still recognized by the UN as a political entity. They can speak. They can be involved in negotiations. The only difference is they cannot, when it comes to a vote on anything, they and the Palestinians as well, the only two non-voting members, cannot vote. But other than that, they have the full rights and recognition as a political entity, as a nation, at the table in the UN. And that flag will fly to honor the Pope coming to America this week. There's, you know, that's a powerful entity. And that's what I see is this Ten King, somehow Catholicism, I believe, is going to fit into this Ten King Federation, because I believe chapter 17 of Revelation is Catholicism, the woman that's seated upon that beast. And the ten horns come out of that thing as well. There's a relationship there. So any questions or comments there before we... Danny.
I don't know if you've heard or not, and I don't I don't even have the terms tonight to tell you, but there's, and I don't know if it was the UN or the EU or whatever, but they kind of cut the world in 10 sections, let's say. Like, the United States is grouped with Canada, United States and Mexico, and that makes up one of the sections, and they've done that throughout the whole world. Give these 10
regions.
Whatever. And I'm just wondering if that's not going to be a part of that deal. And I don't think Israel's part of it, or they didn't.
Oh, imagine that. Because they don't recognize Israel.
So Israel is not part of the UN.
Israel is part of the UN.
Okay.
Yeah. He's talking about the European Union.
I just thought maybe they're keeping out of that. So the European Union is different than the UN. Yeah, European Union would be Europe.
Yep. It was the common market.
Yeah.
And then as they expanded and became more of a tightly knit together entity, they became the European Union because they got their own currency. And I'm not sure how many nations are involved in that. You have any idea? It's about 13, I think.
Yeah, it's somewhere around 13,
15. So. It's like Britain and Spain and France and Germany and all those are Switzerland and, you know, somewhere. There's more than 10, I know that. Somewhere around 12 or 13. So. Any other questions or comments? That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. So that, I mean, that could how this thing gets to this 10. And that would make it the whole world and not just Europe. So, anyone else? Go back to Revelation 17. But this, whatever this federation is, I try to be careful to not embarrass myself by getting too dogmatic about some of these things, because it's, you know, you do, and then all of a sudden, oops, I was wrong. You know, I have to confess my errors enough. I don't want to deliberately put myself up to have to do that. So it's interesting, and that could be the fulfillment, but I'm not going to say that it is. But somehow there's these 10 that come together to make war with the Lamb. Verse 14 again, these shall make war with the Lamb shall overcome them, for He is Lord of lords, King of kings, and they that are with Him are called and chosen and faithful. Verse 15, and He saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, and we looked at this already, it relates back to verse 1 because the beast came out and seated on the waters. He says, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So the scripture identified that as being, you know, what the waters were representing. And a lot of times the scriptures will just, if you just read it, the interpretation is there. The explanation of what the thing means is right there. Verse 16, the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. So there is some she is not the 10 horns. But there's a relationship there. But once her purpose is fulfilled, they turn on her. They hate her, and they'll make her desolate and naked, and she'll eat her flesh and burn her with fire. That's how Satan operates. He uses people up, and then he throws them away or destroys them. The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. That's what Satan does. That's how he has always done. That's how he will always do. And as much as he has had a very close relationship with this whore, at the appropriate time, just a piece of garbage kicked to the side. Verse 17, for God hath put in their hearts, God put in their hearts, that is, these ten horns, these ten kings, to fulfill His will. Well, there's your Calvinism. Yeah, God can do it if He wants to. And in this case, He did. He put it in their hearts to destroy her. And to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And again, I point back to that being the Vatican City, the city that reigns over the kings of the earth. And just the idea of a seat at the UN, I think, just further supports that argument. Questions or comments? Chapter 18. After these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. This angel descends and is going to pronounce the fall of Babylon, and he illuminates the earth with his glory. Verse 2, and he cried mightily and with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. So it falls and becomes the habitation of all these evil creatures here. Let's go back to chapter 14 for a second. Look at some passages that I believe that relate to this. Chapter 14 and verse 8. There followed another angel with saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she had made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Chapter 16 and verse 9. The men were scorched with great heat and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues, and they repented not to give Him glory. That doesn't look right. I think verse 19 is what I wanted. The great city was divided into three parts. The cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of His wrath. The fall of Babylon has been spoken of before. Somebody asked me, well, is there a distinction? I think it's the same that we've seen in chapter 17. But in chapter 17, it's a spiritual aspect. In chapter 18, we see the economic and the political aspect. But it's all one and the same. After reading and looking at, and people were divided on this thing, but that's kind of where I've settled on this thing at this point. Look at verse 10 of chapter 18. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. And remember, the kings had 1 hour with the beast. In 1 hour his judgment has come. There's a connection there, I think. Go to Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13. And verse 19. Isaiah 13, 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now when Isaiah is prophesying and writing this thing, neither kingdom of Israel has been captured yet. The north went first into captivity to the Assyrians. 125 years later, the south was captured by the Babylonians. So chapter 13, the first captivity hasn't even come yet. And yet here he's already speaking about, I believe, what we're reading about in chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation. Again, verse 19, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees, excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. and it shall never be inhabited. That's what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. To this day, it's not been re-inhabited. God destroyed it. He says that's how Babylon is going to be. It shall not ever be inhabited, neither shall be dwelled in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherd make their fold there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and the wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. Isaiah spoke of what John is now speaking about in chapter 18. The habitation of all these unclean creatures. Look at Jeremiah 51. Now, Jeremiah, of course, prophesies after Isaiah and prophesied through the Babylonian captivity. So he started before it came, but then continued on while it was taking place, and even beyond to some degree. Jeremiah 51 and I think I've got verse 12, but I think I want verses 1 and 2. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in the midst of them that rise up against me a destroying wind, and will send into Babylon fanners that shall fan her and shall empty her land. For in the day of trouble they shall be against her round about. Against him that bendeth, let the archer bend his bow. Against him that lifteth himself up in his brigandine, and spare ye not her young men, destroy ye utterly all her host. Thus the slain shall fall in the land of the Chaldeans, and they that are thrust through in her streets. For Israel hath not been forsaken, nor Judah of his God. And the Lord of hosts, though their land was filled with sin against the Holy One of Israel, flee out of the midst of Babylon. Now, in just a moment in Revelation, the next verse I think it is, it says, flee out of Babylon. In Revelation 18. Here, Jeremiah says, flee out of the midst of Babylon and deliver every man his soul. And be not cut off in their iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He will render unto her a recompense. Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand. They made all the earth drunken, and the nations have drunken of her wine. Therefore the nations are mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed. Howl for her, take balm for her pain. If so be, she may be healed. The destruction of Babylon. Let's see. Verse 60. Start at verse 59. The word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Seraiah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, into Babylon in the fourth year of his reign. And this Seraiah was a quiet prince. So Jeremiah wrote in a book all the evil that should come upon Babylon, even all these words that are written against Babylon. And Jeremiah said to Seraiah, when thou comest to Babylon, and shalt see and shalt read all these words. So this is written in a book. It's given to this man. He says, go to Babylon with this message. And when thou comest to Babylon, and shalt see and shalt read all these words, go there and read it, he says. Then shalt thou say, O Lord, thou hast spoken against this place to cut it off, that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but it shall be desolate forever. So it's not talking about the destruction by the Greeks, the conquering by the Greeks. It's forever, he says. And it shall be, when thou hast made an end of reading this book, thou shalt bind a stone to it, and cast it into the midst of Euphrates, and thou shalt say, thus shall Babylon sink, and shall not rise from evil that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. Let's see, where was that? I messed up. Yeah, I probably shouldn't have read that one yet. Yeah. Well, let's go to verse 21 of chapter 18. We'll go ahead and I did it, so we'll. Revelation 18:21. Of course, all the verses in between here talk about her destruction. And he says this in verse 21, "And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all." So this whole thing has been prophesied before, and for John now, it's finally all coming together. And he sees the final and the complete and the total destruction of the nation of Babylon here. Questions or comments? Ben. There's a connection, but yes.
So the Babylon is simply it's the idol worship. It's the Babylonian connection.
That's part of it. It's much more than that, though. Maybe that'll become more clear as we go on here in chapter 18. Right? Anyone else before we go on here? Verse 3. And we'll probably go through this chapter pretty quickly here because there's I think most of it's self-explanatory. Verse 3. So here's the reason for the destruction, why it becomes this hold of all these unclean creatures and everything and uninhabited. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. So it's more than just ancient Babylon. Because somehow this Babylon that's being spoken of here in chapter 18 has enriched merchants of the world. And nations of the world have drunk of the wine of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. So they're all tied into this Babylon that's here in Revelation chapter 18. There's a direct connection to nations and kings and the merchants of the earth. And they've all benefited by their association with her. Spiritual, political, and economic. But it's all going to be destroyed. Let's see. When the Antichrist comes to power, how does he come to power? What's he do to gain his power? Peace and unity, right? And if I've got this right, Babylon is a key to generating that peace and that unity. That's what's used by him to bring all this together, a great ecumenical movement. And again, just look at what's going on today. Look at the way people are fawning over this man that's coming to this country this week. Who has a seat, not him personally, but his organization has a seat at the table at the UN. And they deliberately have, the Palestinians want a voting seat, okay? And the article I read about this today, the Vatican doesn't want that. Oh, we want to remain neutral. Why? pull the strings. If they tip their hand in any way, they're going to make somebody mad. But if they have the appearance of being completely objective and neutral, it sets them up to be the tool in the hand of the Antichrist to be this great uniter that brings it all together, that's a part of ushering in the peace. And what's the Pope doing now? Climate change, peace. There's another thing I think that he's been pushing lately too. But just watch this. Just read and think about what's going on today. And I think it just becomes more and more clear. Ben?
He seems to be everything that the Obama administration is for. A lot of that. I mean, seriously, it's like this whole movement is going toward that direction.
Yep.
Not everything. He wants nothing to do with this here homosexuals and all that stuff. And Obama bringing that into this downturn when he's coming. The Vatican is very upset about
it. I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah. They don't see what they want to do is trying to get all these people close to them so they can take a picture and say, oh, they're with them. And it's not going over very good.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
But I think the Vatican has lightened their stand a little bit. Maybe not a lot, but a little bit on homosexuality. Well, Obama's just rubbing it in his face.
Well, that's what they're saying, that Obama's trying to do.
Yeah. But there's... just watch it. Look at verse... Let's go to verse... Oh, never mind. We're after 7 o'clock. Any questions or comments? We'll stop there tonight. And this new week could be very interesting to just observe and see all that plays out. All that takes place. Ron?
I don't know if you had the answer to this or not. It's,
probably not.
it's about the Vatican. Who is actually the political power of the Vatican? I don't know the answer to that. It just occurred to me that, you know, I don't know necessarily that it's Pope.
It's, and I don't know how much credibility to give to this. So, yes, the obvious answer is the Pope. But there's alleged to be a black Pope. And not as in an African-American Pope, but a secret or dark Pope that actually pulls the strings. And I just don't know. I'm not going to dismiss it, but I don't know that if I accept it. And within the Catholic Church, probably the SS troops of the Catholic Church are the Jesuits. And I forget what they call the head of the Jesuits. Maybe somebody can help me out there. There's a... No, that's just another... that's one group or organization of monks. But the Jesuits themselves are the Gestapo or the SS troops within the Roman Catholic Church. They were pushed the Spanish Inquisition. They were in control of that. And throughout history, they've been the ones that have really been the militant arm and attack dogs when anything's been going on. And there's some that speculate that actually the head of the Jesuits is truly the behind the scenes puppet master of Roman Catholicism, whereas and the Pope is just a figurehead. But I'm throwing that out, but I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not. But I do know the Jesuits are a power to be reckoned with. And there is not always complete harmony between the Pope and the Jesuits in what they're doing. Dan, you have something?
That's an interesting thought, this black Pope. How you said it. Because the white Pope changes out every so many years.
Mm-hmm.
school they pull from.
It's been a while since I've even read some stuff about that, so I'm kind of foggy on just exactly the name of the guy and you know, his title and all that stuff. But there, I think there's something there, but I just don't know how much credibility to give to that. Any other questions or comments before we close tonight? But keep in mind, Roman Catholics are not the enemy. They are simply caught in a system that's taking them to hell, and they need the gospel. You don't get to be a pope without knowing what's going on. He's the enemy, okay? But the individual Catholics are not, and they need us to love them and to witness to them and to be a friend to them. So, let's bow for prayer. Lord, not sure if I presented well the material tonight, and even in my own mind a little bit confused on some things here, or unclear of how I presented it. So just straighten out any messes that I might have made tonight, Father, and help us, Lord, help me especially to be objective in looking at this and to see what you want for us to see in this, and to give to your people what they need to have from this. Probably not a lot of edification out of what we've looked at and talked about tonight, but maybe to see some connections in the Word of God and how you've put this thing together, and ultimately you are in control. And praise God, in the end we win. Thank you, God, for that hope, that promise, that surety. And God, help us to go through this week with a confidence, knowing that we serve the God of the universe, the mighty master who even cares about a boy and a bicycle and a bat and a glove. And if you care about those things, how much more do you care about the things that are of greater significance in our lives? Oh God, just help us to trust you. In Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen.